Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of our other episodes at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody, this is Season 3, Episode number 22 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio, we have the full team assembled.
Kaylee!
Simon!
Nice work remembering your names, both of you, that's an excellent start. In today's episode...
One word reviews today, hello. Goodbye.
It's a short show. In today's episode, we journey to Oz to meet the great and powerful. And both of us, Kaylee and I, we go back to university, don't we, for liberal arts. And did you see 21 and Over?
No.
Oh, come on.
Have you got your old leather jacket out from when you went to varsity? Remember you used to wear leather jackets?
I used to work at at summer camp with a guy named Jeff Chang, and I just couldn't bring myself to watch 21 and Over. Too real. Too real.
Too close to home.
Yeah.
Also in the show today, I interview the writer-director of the new New Zealand film in cinemas, The Red House. Alex Duncan is the person I was talking to yesterday, so we'll be dropping that into the show later on as well. But first, time to have a look at what is in the mailbag. Kaylee.
Yes. Well, first of all, thank you to all of our new followers or subscribers or whatever you have. We call them on Letterboxd. We get emails when people follow us, so it's like getting little tiny bits of fan mail all week. It's lovely.
Yep. And I have tasked myself with keeping our Letterboxd presence up to date. So after every show, I make sure that our film diary is up to date. As it's a collective, it's a sort of communistical sort of collective approach. Even the ones you haven't seen, we still tick the box and say Cinematic has seen them.
That's so good. And so now I can finally say, you know, what's in the box? And there is going to be something
there. Will be.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant.
Fantastic. Oh, it'll get in somewhere.
Yeah. Mm. We'll have to get some audio.
What's in the box? Tell me. That's how I storm into work every day, isn't it, Kaylee?
Yeah.
Tell me what's in the box. Oh, we've got so many replies.
This must be such a fun place to work at.
Sometimes it's scary. It's actually something we were just talking about before we went to air. Reese Pie, one of our fans, said, just out from seeing Side Effects, two-word review, what the...
This is a film that...
we'd all like to say that.
It's been released in Australia already. It sort of came from the States to Australia pretty rapidly and has sort of come to a full stop, hasn't it?
It's not being released. Found out today, for sure. It's not going to be released for the New Zealand market.
This is what may well be, or what the director is threatening to be, his final film. It's a Steven Soderbergh film, and he has suggested in interviews that he is retiring from making cinema. He will go back to making theatre and maybe some, if he's tempted into some of that long form television that is so popular nowadays, he may do that. Who knows? This is a threat that he's made before, and he has changed his mind before, so who knows? But very disappointing that a filmmaker as important over the last 20 years as Steven Soderbergh, that New Zealanders won't get to see it.
Maybe Bill can help us out.
Yeah, I suspect that it might be on the
shelves before that. Who knows?
That's right, straight to DVD. So it may just you know, this is a whole accelerated process nowadays, and with no World Cinema Showcase anymore. And this is something we're going to talk about a little bit later on. With no World Cinema Showcase, there's no autumn festival to sort of mop up a half a year's worth of waifs and strays. I know it was a bit more serious. It was a little bit more serious than that, but it was, I mean, that was a lot of what the showcase did was, you know, look at those films that the majors had on their slates that that they weren't going to release and just drop them in.
And all they need is a little bowl of milk and they would turn up. But now, not anymore.
Tickle them under the chin.
Tickle them under the chin.
Yes. Yep. Miriam Ruth Ross, her two-word review for Oz the Great and Powerful, Stereo Spectacular Alchemy, and I'll be reading some more of her full review from her review blog.
And we'll have a link to her her blog, her website, in the show notes, which is on the show page on the website, because I suggest you check in often to that, mm-hmm. because she, particularly with 3D, it's her specialised field. She does make some very, very interesting points about what she sees. And, you know, it isn't just sort of the art house stuff, it's commercial cinema as well, which makes a nice change.
Mm-hmm. And after our discussion last week on the show about Great Expectations and Ray Winstone, sorry, I must have mispronounced it Winston on the show.
Oh, it is Winston.
Oh.
Winstone.
Yeah, it's written Winstone, but it's actually Winston.
Wow.
Oh.
At least that's how everybody in England pronounced it when I was there. I was there in England last year.
Ray Winston, all right.
Yep. Ray W's last name aside.
Ray W. Mm-hmm.
Reese Pye and Robert Caddo sent me the link that he played Magwitch in the BBC version a couple of years ago.
Oh, he'd been good.
Mm.
Yeah, so there is a version with him in it, the character I wanted him to play.
There you go.
Already done.
I think we should be hiring ourselves out as consultants to Hollywood. Mm. I mean, the number of times we've come up with really killer ideas here, right around this table, and, you know, we just give them away for free to people, really, don't we? So, that's our mailbag. I don't want to cut you off in, you know,
that's
your prime.
It for the week.
All right.
There's lots more. Follow us on Twitter to see what else.
Yes, indeed. and lots of news that if you follow us on Twitter, you'll get. You don't need to follow anybody else, really, except maybe me and Kaylee.
Because I don't do Twitter.
Yeah. But also, I didn't put in the news today, but it was announced today, or recently, probably not today, but recently, that there will be a sequel to Trainspotting.
Oh, yes. Mm. Yes.
And will Ewan be in it?
Yes. Yeah. He's going to bring back the original cast. It's the sequel. It's based on the book by Irvine Welsh, which is the sequel to Trainspotting.
And they've been waiting for all of the actors to get old enough.
Was it BB or whatever, the crazy guy that used to beat people? Bigby. Like, I wonder if he's kind of he's probably found religion or something.
Well, I suggest that you download porno to your Kindle.
Right.
The book.
The book, yeah. And
I'm glad about that. I don't want to get in trouble. Yeah, thanks, Dan. Just, hold on, dear. I'm just downloading some porn.
Just for your homework. It's research.
Homework. Mm. Yep.
So, yeah, and the plan is for it to be released on the 20-year anniversary of the original Trainspotting.
Well, there'll be queues around the block, I suspect, for that when it comes out.
Hopefully it's not straight to video here.
Who knows?
You know,
depends on the distributor, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Really?
If you're listening.
So what have people been going to see? I know that there's been a lot of talk about the international box office and how Oz has sort of rescued an industry in the doldrums in America. It's like the first $100 million hit
for a long while.
So how's it done here?
Sorry, I choked on my water. Number 5, down from 4, Silver Linings Playbook. 4 at 4, Good Day to Die Hard. Opening at 3, 21 and Over. Down to 2 from 1, I Give It a Year. And opening in the number 1 spot, Oz the Great and Powerful.
Right. Ooh. And what's the sort of screen average for let's take a completely random comparison. I Give It a Year and Oz the Great and Powerful, because they're both pretty wide releases.
Yeah, different weeks though.
Mm. Right, so second week, isn't it, for I Give It a Year?
Second week, I think, I Give It a Year.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so what the screen average is always interesting.
It is interesting, yeah.
Oz the Great and Powerful, total New Zealand box office to date, Oz is definitely much higher than I Give It a Year.
But you'd expect, I think, I Give It a Year had between a 40% and 50% drop-off in week 2.
Yep.
38.3.
Oh, okay, there you go. 38.3 drop off. So, and that's through to Sunday though. That doesn't include Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Mm. So you'd expect it to maybe accelerate over those 3 days. But yeah, so Oz opening with a big average, and you'd expect that in week 1.
And I know that we talked about I Give It a Year last week, and I hadn't seen it, but I thought I'd just throw my 10 cents in and suggest that it is a new low in British cinema.
How low?
British
can
comedy.
You go?
Well, obviously lower than I thought is the answer. What a horrible bunch of people all in one film at the same time. Mm. How anybody thought that you could make a film that had like no redeeming characters whatsoever. And the laughing at them. You laugh at everybody, not with anybody. It's got no soul.
It's like they're trying to make the British Office fan group a movie, but That comedy
and trade on that whole Britcom thing, which is genuinely popular. You know, you think about Notting Hill and Four Weddings and a Funeral, and how Love Actually still just is people are mopping. You're having to mop people up at Christmas now with Love Actually every year, and yet, and here we are. You know, they're trading on that fine history with something that was really, really quite nasty. And it didn't surprise me at all that it turned out to be produced by the written by the Borat guy, because the Borat and the Bruno films were also pretty nasty pieces of work, except that they were saved by a fantastic performance, or by, you know, Sacha Baron Cohen, his virtuoso performance sort of rescued those. But if you took a step back and looked at those films, you realised that actually it was pretty mean, both of them.
No, see, I'm not on the same page. I mean, Borat, I thought, was just wonderful because it was taking so many, you know, pot shots at so many things. I mean, Bruno was pretty sort of tame and silly. Yeah, I agree. But I thought Borat was actually kind of almost like a genre, you know, a new type of genre. And it was a satirical sort of film. You know, it took shots at things, which, yeah, Bruno certainly didn't. Yeah.
Yep. All right. Well, noted. But, you know, it wouldn't bother me if we never got another one. To be honest,
I'd be fine with that.
So that is the box office. Time to actually give our verdict on this Oz thing.
A great wizard from Kansas. A dark shadow is cast across this land. I've waited for you to set things right.
Great people of Oz, your wizard is here! How hard could it be to kill a wicked witch?
You don't know much about witches, do you? You're the only one strong enough to save us all. You're going to lead us into battle and take back the throne.
We're going to need everyone to believe.
It amazes me how long it's taken for a prequel to The Wizard of Oz to actually make it into cinemas, because the series of books by L. Frank Baum are beloved in America. They're children's favorites. They're also in the public domain, so there's no rights at stake. So, you know, anybody can make them. And of course, you'd be trading on one of the most beloved films in the history of cinema, The Wizard of Oz, with Judy Garland, right? So it strikes me as kind of odd that it's taken this long for somebody to go back to the beginning and to try and, you know, explain how the great wizard got there behind his curtain. And the question is, was it worth the wait? I suppose. We've got James Franco playing Oz, the carnival magician, and in true Wizard of Oz style, the film starts out in black and white and in 4:3 ratio as he's in Kansas getting himself into a bit of trouble, really, at his sort of carnival circus sideshow. And he's escapes.
Not an honest man, is he?
He's not an honest man. Yeah. He's not honest about.
He's flawed.
You could say that. he's chased by his creditors and the various people who are after him. He sets off in a hot air balloon to try and escape them. Gets caught in one of those magical tornadoes and is transported to them the land of Oz, where it turns into CinemaScope and not Technicolor, because it's DCP and it doesn't really work quite the same way anymore, does it?
But you can describe it as, I think, Fujicolor.
Fujicolor.
Like, Fuji is known for those, like, really, really saturated greens and yellows. So.
Well, there you go. You learn something.
There was
one
of those tornadoes in the Manukau Market on the news the other day. Remember that little swirling around? Just a little low-level one going through the market.
It would transport you to Gore.
Opportunity lost.
Take me to Gore. Jump on in. Yeah.
So he ends up in Oz. And the first person he meets discovers that his name is Oz, like the land, and that he's a magician, and therefore the prophecy is about to be fulfilled, and he is going to be able to protect the citizens of this land and become responsible for all of the treasure that is in the vault. And of course, it's the treasure that really gets his sparks his interest, as well as the pretty girl who's given him this information. But nothing is as it seems, which is pretty much, you know, what you'd expect from an Oz film. And he meets a lot of interesting, mostly digital characters, a winged monkey, a little girl made of china that he fixes with a bit of glue. And so how do you feel about this one, Kaylee? Did you feel that its fantasticalness connected back to The Wizard of Oz well enough, as well as being a 21st century family movie?
I think they did.
You're going to tell me you haven't seen The Wizard of Oz now, aren't you? You're going to tell
me. Of course I have. I've seen it so many times.
Oh, that's good.
And I'm a really big fan of Wicked, the musical. Yeah. So Wicked, yeah, the book which became the Broadway musical, which hopefully one day they'll make into a film, is the prequel story of how the witches came together, and how that's a different story about how the evil witch became evil. This one, I enjoyed it. I was entertained. It was really beautiful, but I felt it was quite flawed at the same time. You do get a bit of the setup. So in the original Wizard of Oz, almost all the characters that you meet in Oz are played by the same people, like the evil woman on the street, and you know, the Tin Man and the Lion.
Yeah. So you there are clues to the dream-like sort of nature of Oz and what it represents, aren't there, when you watch the original?
Yeah, but in this one, they didn't quite have enough of the characters there. You do see Michelle Williams. She's sort of this love interest that he kind of comes into town, and Zach Braff, who voices the winged monkey, he's his secondhand man in the magic show. But yeah, there wasn't quite enough of that set up to link them together. And it was a bit disappointing, because if you've seen The Wizard of Oz, you know he just goes back to being a bit evil and corrupt in the end anyway. So
yeah, that's right. He's a cheat. Isn't he? He's basically a cheat and a bit of a fraud. And I mean, that's in the original Wizard of Oz. It's that unveiling that there is no wizard is actually the one of the sort of great hearts of that story.
Yeah. So even though this one does has a nice little romantic ending, you're still like, well, you turn into a jerk again, and then you know this young woman has to come and save all of Oz.
So my next question then, well, what's that wonderful one sentence description of The Wizard of Oz? Little girl visits strange land, kills the first person she meets, and then joins up with three strangers to kill again. And so, you know, but this is, you know, when you're talking about a flawed lead character written that way, is James Franco the right? Is he well cast in this? Because
I think so. James Franco, I think he was an interesting choice, because in the public eye he is quite flawed and strange, and he has these art shows, and he has this weird Instagram feed, and people aren't quite sure what he's up to. So I think it was quite fitting for him to be in this film, and he played a really convincing bad guy, you know. But I didn't really believe that he changed at the end.
No, but I think you may be right that may not be the point. My concern about Franco from a classic leading man point of view is that he's starting to look a bit worse for wear. Franco, he's, you know, those late nights and, you know, all those early starts when he was doing General Hospital as an art project or whatever it was, you know, are starting to get to, and you know, the studying and the essays and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, I just wonder whether he's what kind of a future he has as a leading man, you know, just with his looks fading the way they are.
I don't know, but he has worked with Raimi before, obviously, Spider-Man series, and you get a lot of former actors he's worked with before, like Bruce Campbell, made famous in The Evil
Dead.
Well,
yeah, you can't have a Raimi film without Bruce Campbell.
No, yeah. That's true.
Or his brother Ted.
Yes. Was he in this one?
Yeah, he was.
Of where?
He was in a crowd scene somewhere.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I think I saw some other actors in the crowd. I was like, I think those people are actually famous, those extras. I think those are actors.
One of my favourite comments that I saw online this week was the person who said that Oz is now my second favourite James Franco film, which is a prequel to a beloved story that also features CGI monkeys. Oh. Do you get it?
Yep.
Yeah.
Nice.
It's a tough competition.
Although I'd argue that the animation in the other one was better.
Oh yeah. Yeah, well, that's definitely true. But it's an interesting little parallel. You know, is there a third one? A trilogy of prequels with monkeys that he could do.
And of course, the other big thing, speaking of animation, the other big thing of Oz is it is in 3D. It has been presented, it is released in 2D, but 3D is good. So of course, got the review from Miriam here, which I'll read out.
Which will be much more thoughtful than ours, I think.
Yes.
Much more technical.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, how long is this thing? Come on, off we go.
The overt and ostentatious display of how film can play with its own borders recalls early cinema that operated as an attraction concerned with demonstrating its magical trickery.
Take a breath, slow down.
This delight in optical illusions is made clear within the film through the depiction of cinematic toys such as the zoetrope, an albeit improbable modified praxinoscope, which is, I assume, the one that...
The projector version.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you going to do this in the Scottish accent? Because that would be really awesome.
Oh, I can't. The link to early cinema is similar to the one made in Martin Scorsese's Hugo, when the spectacular imaging of stereoscopic film was used to revitalize knowledge of film pioneer Georges Méliès's magic effects in early French cinema.
Good point.
Mm-hmm. Which, I was thinking of Hugo when I was watching it, because the thing that Oz does really well is they have those particles that come out of the screen,
dust.
Much like in Hugo.
Yeah, dust and smoke. Mm. Yeah.
Yes. So yeah. You get these...
It's actually one of the great uses of 3D to texturize all of the depth.
Yeah. Exactly, because a lot of 3D films, it's depth rather than going in instead of coming out at you, which was Hugo did really well, having that dust in the air and other particles that were coming out, which was quite effective. As a truly U.S. production, Oz the Great and Powerful makes reference not to Malay, but to the American cinema and technology inventor Thomas Edison. Mm. And there's a lot more. I'll put a link in the show notes because she goes on about the weakness of the female characters, which I found really interesting. Mm. But yes.
Yeah, well, this is I haven't done my homework on this. Is this actually based on a specific Oz prequel?
No, there is no Oz prequel.
So there's no excuse then for the 1930s attitudes to women. Basically, is there?
Like, correct.
They didn't have to recreate that so thoroughly.
But that would seem a bit unusual, wouldn't it? If they weren't kind of.
I don't know. I think that 50% of your audience are going to be little girls, and they should be getting role models that they can aspire to, rather than Barbie dolls.
Well, reading it, the writer, whose name escapes me right now, of Oz the Great and Powerful, wanted a fairy tale with a strong male character because there aren't many.
Oh.
So.
Yeah.
Mm, so he punished all of his female characters, making them useless, and everyone falls in love with him, and then turn evil because they're in love, which is how Wicked goes. But it's Elphaba, the evil.
Which is also, well, on the subject of witches. This is what Beautiful Creatures is about as well, in that that it's the age of 16, the lead witch. Fate will dictate her nature will dictate whether she becomes a white witch or a black witch, and it's, you know, at the age of 16 you can tell that it's pretty much automatically going to be some kind of representation of her love life, and it's just kind of simplistic, isn't it, really?
But are the witches convincing? Because there's four, isn't there? Is there three or four
three.
Witches?
Three.
There's three witches in this, but there's actually four witches in the story.
Mm. And do they pull it off? Are they convincing?
Well, we don't want to do too much of a spoiler, because there's various transformations that aren't in the trailers, and so therefore should come as a bit of a surprise. But I would say that Michelle Williams is always good and just is lovely. I think it's a terrific performance.
She does really well as Glinda, because Glinda's is like good and kind of flighty and just like...
But it's not one note. It's not.
No,
it's not a one note.
Not.
Like, and she like... like some of her indie movies, you know, she still has the ability to really sort of drag the emotion out of you just with a look, or, you know. Mm. So she's that's a fantastic performance by her, I think. Rachel Weisz is just solidly villainous pretty much all the way through. She's a pantomime villain.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Yeah.
And that's nothing wrong with that. And Mila Kunis, I think, just shows her range has, you know, it extends every time we see her. So I didn't really have a problem with the casting or the performances. I thought the characters were thin rather than the work that the actors did.
Mm.
So it has done nearly $100 million already internationally, and so already there is talk of a sequel.
Squeakle.
Because there's 20 more years before Dorothy gets there and start shaking everything up. Mm. So there's quite a lot of stories still to be told.
And Disney wants to make back its money after the flop of Return to Oz many years ago.
Yep. And but in the Los Angeles Times there was an interesting article earlier on this week saying that Warner's, who own the Wizard of Oz, and who are partly responsible for the fact that three different Oz projects got started and then not completed because they didn't sort of have the guts to push them through, are now trying to rapidly get those projects back on back on track, because they have the rights to the ruby slippers and the gingham dress and all the rest.
I suspect it was all those years of pushing monkeys off buildings with fake wings and it not working put them off.
My favorite
messy.
My favorite adaptation is The Wiz with Diana Ross.
I mentioned that in my Capital Times review as well. And The Wiz.
Wasn't Michael in there?
Michael Jackson wasn't it. Yes, yeah, Michael Jackson.
Crazy.
A much underrated film, actually.
It's great.
Yeah,
I love it. I wish I could find out on DVD.
Two words for Oz the Great and Powerful.
My two words are gold-coated. It's not gold all the way through, but it does have a very, very shiny exterior.
I'll just see if I can get this down to two words, actually. I sort of felt like it was a very expensive vehicle for cheap sentiment, so expensive cheap would be my two-word review for Oz the Great and Powerful. Time for some news.
On Tuesday, the New Zealand Parliament became film critics by unanimously censoring Ben Affleck's Oscar-winning film Argo for misrepresenting the role of Kiwi diplomats during the Iran hostage crisis in 1979. Please explain.
It's not like we don't have a huge amount of other stuff to be dealt with in this country. You know, can they not be spending their time trying to make it rain for the farmers?
Yeah, like we're thinking of selling off this asset. But look, let's pause that, please, because we want to talk about Argo.
Yeah.
Big stuff.
Nuts.
Yeah. Yep. But, you know.
Well, I hope they're keeping busy today, because today is the second reading of the marriage equality bill, so they better be working.
Yeah, exactly. All of them on deck, please.
Mm. After several days, Baz Luhrmann's The Great Gatsby is surfacing in to open the 66th Cannes Film Festival on May the 15th. It's the second time a 3D movie has opened the festival after Shrek. Sorry, that's not correct. It was Pixar's Up, which launched the 62nd festival in 2009.
I'd love it. I'd love them to have picked Shrek.
Shrek, wouldn't that be great? It'd be riots.
Riots on the Croisette.
Yes.
I forgot that Up opened the film festival.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And so, what have we got date-wise for Gatsby here? It's into Gats. June now, isn't it?
6th of June.
And it was supposed to open May 10th in the States, so now...
I don't think that US date's moved at all, so I think it still is actually going to be... at the moment, the plan is that it still opens in the States before Cannes, and you'd think that they would want to...
it's a bit unusual.
It is. And so that date may change, and I don't know whether if that date changes, then everything will be pushed a few more weeks here. Hold on, but I'm just looking at your whiteboard, so July is empty. Wouldn't you know?
I know. It's
you could do with a bit of Gatsby in July.
Bit of Gatsby. Do a bit of Gatsby now. Bring on the party.
I just want to see the blasted thing. Like, come on.
Yeah.
It's exhausted. Everyone's just exhausted now. Like, oh, just see this already.
You're gonna be like so angry when it comes along. Damn it! I love that.
It's got to be better than the Robert Redford one.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
It would have to be. But Redford was great casting. Like he just, you know, what my memory of that Redford film with Mia Farrow is that everything looked like it was shot through just this haze of Vaseline.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
That's right. Yeah.
It's like
turn on the lights properly.
Everybody, net curtains everywhere you look.
Mm. Yeah. And Mia Farrow was just like drunk all the time or something. Anyway, the World Cinema Showcase is no more. The New Zealand International Film Festival, which has been running the mini festival, has decided to run a series of autumn events instead, featuring restorations of classics like Lawrence of Arabia and Guys and Dolls, as well as previews of new features like Contiki and the ABCs of Death, which was produced by
Mr. Ant Timpson.
Yes,
who also has a relationship with the New Zealand International Film Festival as the programmer of The Incredibly Strange. Mm-hmm. So you can sort of see why that one came about. What is interesting is that they've managed to get access to the Civic for a lot of these screenings in Auckland, which does make a really big difference, I think, and it means that the Civic is a cinema location, like a grand, big screen, state-of-the-art cinema location is going to be used a bit more often, which is very good news.
You want to fill it, though, don't you?
Yeah, exactly. And but in a Wellington context, I would just ask whether, you know, the Roxy out in Miramar have got this season of classic old movies that they've been playing all the way all the way through the year, and they played The Wizard of Oz last week and Casablanca and various other classics. I just wonder whether there's a need for these restored. You know, whether they're filling a big gap or just a gap on the basis of these individual titles. Lawrence of Arabia was playing, the restored digital version of Lawrence of Arabia was playing in the States when I was there, but it was playing as one night stands. It didn't get seasons anymore. Yeah, yeah. It was like a one night special.
Yeah, and that's the right way to do it.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, those things, they only have a certain shelf life. Like, mm-hmm. You can play Casablanca every year for a year if you want, but it's always diminishing. And that's the problem with, I mean, you know, they've got to be well marketed too, and a good spin behind them to sort of get people aware.
I wonder about Guys and Dolls as well, because I don't know if Guys and Dolls is necessarily the most beloved film musical ever. Like, it's, you know, Sinatra's in it, but Brando can't sing, frankly. And this is a film that I actually tried to watch not long ago, and it is actually quite hard to find. Like, the DVD, there is a DVD, I think, available through Fatso, but it's not widescreen. It's so, you know, it would be nice to see that on the very big screen, but it you know, essential.
The one and only time I've seen Guys and Dolls was a high school production. Nobody could sing in that either, so I think that was
I could confess to you that I was actually going to be in Guys and Dolls in a high school production, and none of us were going to be able to sing either. So we got halfway through rehearsals, the rights got pulled from us because the National Theatre were doing it professionally. Isn't that funny? It was like the National Theatre were doing it with Bob Hoskins and people like that. And they
didn't hire you for chorus? That's a bit rude.
I know. I would have probably fitted the costumes.
You guys must have really chewed into their market share.
I know. I've always had a problem with agents ever since. Yeah. My big moment.
Right. There are more announcements.
What about the children, man? What about the children?
Exactly.
Yeah. We are the world. There will be more announcements about the autumn events as they build towards this year's International Festival in July.
Yeah, so I think it's actually quite a smart move, isn't it, to keep interest alive. So rather than one big launch, they're just going to keep feeding information out. And before we know it, it'll be the middle of winter and it'll be festival time.
Mm-hmm.
So, a film that played at the film festival last year all around the country was The Red House, and it got a really strong response from audiences. I think a lot of people, when they went into it thinking that it was a documentary because the two lead characters are the parents of the filmmaker. But it is, in fact, a fiction film. Inspired by events from their life. The film is now being released around the country to various cinemas. It's getting a reasonably wide release. It's already on in Christchurch, and it's getting a reasonably wide release around the country from Thursday and then further, depending on how the box office goes. I spoke with the writer-director of the film, Alex Duncan, yesterday. This project's been around for quite a long time. It played at the New Zealand International Film Festival in July last year, and it's now making its way into cinemas. And so, congratulations for that. Are you excited about the next stage of this of the film's life?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it was fantastic to have it premiere at the film festival last year, and I really loved sort of seeing it in front of an audience at that point. But it's really wonderful that it actually can have a wider life beyond the festival circuit. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about how the project came to be. Where did the idea come from, and how long has it taken for you to get it up, if you like?
Well, from the moment that I had the idea to the moment we completed the edit was about 4 years. From when we started shooting, it was about 3.5 years. So the project started when my father called. I was living in Wellington, and he called to say that he and my stepmother were packing up their home and possibly going to sell the house. And this is a house that I grew up in. And if you've seen the film, the house is very filled of all the detritus of a well-lived life. And for me, it's filled with a lot of the memories of my childhood. So the idea of that home being packed up and everybody sort of moving on was that sort of made me really curious about this idea of what is home, or is it the thing that you carry inside you, or is it where you live,
or is it just the place where your parents are at any given moment?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So I started off to make a little documentary about that, and I had some Creative New Zealand funding to make a short experimental documentary. But then when we went to shoot, my parents had changed their plan and were no longer going to move. And also they came across in a way on camera, which surprised me. I found them really, really interesting. They had a particular sort of presence, which made me want to investigate further.
What was that? Can you try and describe it a little bit? Because it must have been a very brave step for them to take, to become actors in a fiction as opposed to just simply having you wandering around with a camera filming their day-to-day life.
Yeah, and I think actually even that, I mean, originally when I first approached them about making this film, they were like, well, you know, as long as the house is the main character and, you know, well, obviously we don't need to be in it. And I sort of said, well, it would be really good to have you as, well, at least as background extra, so that we'd realise that the house is not abandoned. But then when it came to, yeah, the question is what was their quality? I think there's something really curious about seeing people in a place that they feel very natural in, that is their own home environment, but when they are directed. Coming from dance and theatre, things to do with rhythm and time and the relationship between the camera and the performer are really important to me. So in directing non-performers in that way, I was really curious to sort of see what that sense of presence was, or what that performativity was within a space that they're so comfortable in.
There's going to be a question that I was going to ask later on, but I might as well jump into it now, is that your creativity expresses itself in so many different ways, whether it's through dance and choreography, or you've done the MTA, the Master of Theatre Arts, in directing through Toi Whakaari and Victoria University. And so there's 2 years of theatre training in there as well, and plus short films and now a feature film. Do you have a preference or do you choose a medium based on the quality of the idea or the nature of the idea?
I think it is the latter. I think progressing in my work now, I've realised that I've walked this very lopsided journey with one foot in dance and one foot in film, and then theatre sort of, I don't know, moving in between those two things. And it has, in the past, it's been more, I've been curious about some starting point, and then the vehicle for it or the medium for it has come afterwards. And now, in the creation of this film, it's taken such a long time and it has been such a particular investigation. I think it's really time for me just to hone in on one medium and just continue to investigate film.
Right. This is a film that it seems to me that it works on so many different levels, but one of the things that struck me the most was that it's about contrast, and a contrast between a New Zealand remote rural existence and a Beijing urban city existence, where people are living sort of shoulder to shoulder and sort of cheek by jowl with, you know, overlooking each other. So there's that. There's also, you know, the cultural difference between contrasts between Chinese and New Zealand life, and also, you know, age, the nature of aging and the contrast between generations. Was that something that emerged through the process, or was that something that you were wanting to investigate from the beginning?
Well, I think the way that I usually conceptualize work as it is about sort of dualities. So within this one, I was really curious about, you know, a man and a woman. So a woman from the east, a man from the west, a small island in a large city. And so in a way, there were sort of formal qualities that I placed on the work that I sort of wanted to look at the work from those different contrasting perspectives. In terms of it being particularly about, I mean, this is something that has sort of come up. I made it in my home, my childhood home in New Zealand, and then we shot the second half in China. It's not for me specifically about those two places. It's more about the ideas of, you know, moving between two worlds, or how you do sort of work as a cross-cultural couple between two completely contrasting cultures, rather than being specifically about those two particular places. Yeah, and something that I thought was that drew my curiosity initially was when I came upon this idea of is it the physical space that is important for your identity, or is it the love or the relationship that you have? When I transposed that idea from that little tiny house into a place like China that has changed a huge, you know, a great deal over the last 20 years, I thought that that was a really, that's a fascinating and amazing thing to look at, where it's not just one house that's changed, it's a whole population and a whole, you know, it's a vast space that's shifted and transformed over those years.
And this was one of the things about the film that was interesting to me, was this this presentation of Beijing life, modern Beijing life, and how, you know, I had sort of half expected that a country that was ostensibly communist would be looking after its older citizens a little better than it appears to be doing. You know, the parents of the character played by your stepmother seem to be not terribly well looked after at all until she comes out from New Zealand to take care of them. Is that fair?
I think probably for any family and for any, I think it's probably different depending on where you would be. I mean, the fact that I ended up shooting in Beijing is purely because I had an artist residency there. So that the research that I did was not just about Beijing, but it was sort of wider than that. I think it really depends on the particular status of each family and their particular circumstance. It certainly is different to New Zealand, where you have more of, you know, you have retirement villages, and where we have sort of government funding in a way that is not in China. Yeah,
it's fascinating. Yeah. The film itself is endlessly fascinating on a personal and individual level, as well as on in terms of the big sort of the sweeping aspects of it. How has the film been responded to by other festivals around the world? Have you been getting screenings outside of New Zealand?
Oh, well, this has been a terrible sadness, actually. We've gone into about three festivals so far, and really lovely little sweet festivals, but not of the A-list variety that every filmmaker dreams of. So yeah, this is sort of like a continuing sort of work in progress.
And the film is now going to be screening in cinemas in a few places, and it's from we're recording this on a Tuesday, so it's opening in Auckland and Wellington on Thursday, the 14th of March. Are there plans to take it further afield around New Zealand as well?
Yeah, so it opened last week in Christchurch on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, at Alice Cinematheque, and it's had a really lovely following there so far over the last few days, and it opens in about 14 cinemas, most of them on the 14th, and a couple of them, I think Dunedin and Nelson, opening on the 21st, and hopefully it'll spread from there. But 14 cinemas all at once is about as much as we can deal with at this time. So we're sort of doing a slightly staggered release.
Oh, that seems perfectly reasonable. It gives it a chance for word to get out around the country. We'll be following your progress very closely. So thank you very much, Alex, for being on Cinematica. Best of luck with your film, The Red House.
Thanks very much.
Jeff Chang!
Listen, I can't go out tonight.
Jeff Chang, you're 21 years old now.
Your a-hole dad isn't here anymore.
Dickwads.
He's totally here.
Yep, that's definitely his voice.
Right?
Your interview is at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. Be rested, be sharp, do not embarrass me.
Jeff Chang, this isn't just any birthday. This is your 21st birthday. This is the day that you become a man. This is the day that you get to tell every bouncer who's ever carded you.
21.
Blackjack mother...
All right, 21 and over. This is
another American comedy based on racism.
Not based on racism, but racism is woven very tightly through the entire thing. I don't think it's like a foundation.
Oh, there's no sexism. It's just racism.
Oh, there's not enough sexism.
Oh, okay.
No, not for a teen comedy, or not a teen comedy, but for one of those sort of Porky's American Pie style films.
Listening to that, I thought, well, there's another Stifler. It's just that guy's just being Stifler. Come on, man, let's go.
Yep, mm-hmm. yep. Pretty much. There's a lot of those sort of cliched characters involved in that, and you will be not surprised to learn that this film was written by the two guys who wrote The Hangover.
Oh, yep, that's what I thought. I'm just saving it up for The Hangover 3. I'll watch that.
But they are not. They haven't written. They haven't actually been involved in the Hangover 2 and Hangover 3, because they pretty much all they did for The Hangover was write the premise, which is they wake up.
Right.
And they have to retrace their steps. And I think a lot of that script got taken out of their hands after it went into production. But they have recycled this idea pretty effectively here, because what we have is some college kids who, and in the opening scene, two pals, they're walking naked across the quad with wearing only tube socks, and they have
we've all been there.
Yeah, brands on their backsides, and
not there.
And then so the whole film is about how did this come to be? What was their night like that turned things into this? And so no great surprises. There's lots of people behaving obnoxiously towards each other, but you know, and it surprises me as much as anyone to know that there's a but involved here. It's not without some heart to it at the end, you know. Like, it's really, what it's really about is about male friendship and what happens when the friends you met at primary school or kindergarten, and you go through high school, and then you go off to different colleges, and you lose touch, and like, what does that mean for your friendship, and what is male friendship anyway? When you know, as you get older, and you go your separate ways. So it seemed to me that it's not without some interest. That's pretty much the final quarter of the film, so I don't know how many people listening to this show would still be left in the cinema at that point, because it is fairly gross, very sweary, and a lot of their behaviour is pretty obnoxious. But you know, the different foibles and failings of the characters get revealed, and you learn a bit about them. There's a bit of character development, which is a lot more than there was in I Give It a Year. I mean, seriously, I Give It a Year makes 21 and over look like Chinatown. It's like, it's, you know, what was Project X? Was that last year? Well, that was pretty awful. Hmm. That really had no redeeming characteristics whatsoever. Whereas 21 and over, I reckon, has just a little sliver, a little hint of something about it that meant that it wasn't a complete waste of time. So maybe that's. So can I turn that into two words?
You can.
Hmm.
Not wasted. Oh, that kind of works, actually. Hmm. Yeah.
Speaking of Chinatown, what was the reference to the sign to Chinatown in Wizard of Oz? Or, sorry, Oz the Great and Powerful.
Oh, I don't know.
If anyone can answer this question...
Yeah, tweet us with
that,
please.
I'll send you a prize. Maybe I'll, like, bake you something or come to your house and make you toast. I didn't get it, and people were laughing, and I was like, ugh. But.
Yeah, I had to watch that film at a 10 in the morning screening, so I wasn't really in the mood for laughing at very much, actually, during Oz. So, and may, in fact, have dropped off to sleep at a couple of moments.
I watched it surrounded by uni students.
Oh, really? Mm. In togas? Because we were talking about that a bit earlier on. Is it not toga party season?
Some people opted to go to Cheap Tuesday to see Oz.
Right. as
not in togas, though.
No, okay.
No. No,
all right. So, 21 and over, I suspect it will find a little bit of an audience, but not very much of one, partly because I think that films that have come before it have sort of queered the picture a wee bit, unfortunately. So, maybe, you know, even a film that's got a little bit about it, you know, no one's going to give us stuff. So, time to look at the other side of college life, the artistic, sensible, mature aspect of it, sensitive side of it. Oh, he said with the wrong screen open. Here we go.
I know Ohio is not as glamorous as New York, but they're throwing
me a retirement dinner thing.
When is it?
Weekend of the 25th. You know, check your schedule.
Checking now. Looks like I'd have to shift some things around. I'll be there.
I never met anyone that I trusted until now.
I'm 35.
It doesn't bother me.
Well, it bothers me.
My advice to you is put some armor around that gooey little heart of yours.
Right, liberal arts. And Kaylee, you are, of all of us around the table, the one closest to college age, so...
You have the floor.
Yeah.
Off you go.
I can be Elizabeth Olsen. Mm-hmm.
Zibby.
Zibby. So, yes, this is Josh Radnor's second film.
Apparently he's some kind of big cheese on the television, is that right?
He is, yes. He has a very good running television main character thing going on, How I Met Your Mother. Although we don't talk about TV on the show.
No, but yeah.
Yeah, so liberal arts is semi-autobiographical, as you can tell if you watch it, about, is it Jesse?
Yes.
Yes, Jesse, a man who graduated from college many years ago, and his one of his favorite professors is having a retirement party.
Richard Jenkins, the brilliant, brilliant, lovely Richard Jenkins, who elevates everything he gets in touch with.
I know. I was so worried he was going to like commit suicide or something in the film the whole time. I was panicking.
But what a wonderful depth. Every scene, there was, you got every single aspect, every corner of his character was on show. Brilliant.
Mm. Jesse, played by the writer-director Josh Radnor, goes, he's kind of doesn't like his job, lives in New York, is feeling a bit lost, goes to this retirement party and meets this young student who reinvigorates his zest pour vie, and they, you know, they read books and write letters to each other. It's very romantic and very sort of naive, and he has to come to terms with the fact that
they write letters to each other, don't they? Handwritten letters. She insists upon it.
Very and when they, soppy, when they talk about, romantic, yeah, over the top.
Oh, she introduces letters. Him to classical music.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Oh, when I listen to this music walking through New York, it's like I'm seeing things for the first time. Which, to be fair, I've met people who've written me letters like that. So I was like, I can relate to this.
I don't believe for a moment that
these people
it
are
hasn't
there.
Happened. Yeah.
Yeah. But she is much younger than he is, and he has to deal with that when she decides that she wants him to swipe her V-card. Wow.
Yeah, I felt like that was... That there was... yeah.
That's what the kids call it.
Swipe. Right. Okay.
That sounds like a robbery, though.
It is a robbery.
Oh.
Man. I just want to point out that I think the undercurrents of romance, the romance going on between them, is palpable there, right? Mm. It shouldn't have come as any great surprise to him that she comes onto him this way. I think the surprise to him is that he would be her first, and that is what sort of freaks him out, I think. But I bet you if she hadn't have told him that, he would have been in like Flynn, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But really, it is about romance, but it's really about growing older. and yep. growing up. And
very, it's actually, that's one of the things that disappointed me a little bit about it, was because it ended up being very conservative in terms of its conclusions, that actually you really do, you should stay with your own generation because you will have more in common and, you know, so.
It's true, because the younger generation are batshit crazy.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, but that's bonkers. Fun, isn't it? That's actually part of the point.
My man friend, I had to explain to my man friend who Jay-Z was the other day in the car.
Oh, well, that's no good.
No. Yeah. So, you know, there's generational gaps, but it's okay. But that's because he stopped listening to music in the 90s, so...
After Phil Collins.
But that's actually one of the things that combined sort of intergenerational relationship together, that sort of, you know, explaining things, you know, you must see this. You know, tried to show you Die Hard the other day, and you threw it back in my face. But it doesn't mean that doesn't mean that we won't still try. Yeah. So,
have you seen Mean Girls?
No, I haven't seen Mean Girls.
We should watch Mean Girls together because
that's a much better idea than
The
Notebook.
Let's stay on target here, guys.
Yeah. See, that's something you're probably like, "What the hell?" I'd be like, "No, this is my Die Hard."
Okay. All right. So, liberal arts. My question to you is, first of all, Elizabeth Olsen or Jennifer Lawrence? I think that they're two similar generation. They both got their start in quite a big, strong, dramatic art house picture, and Jennifer Lawrence's career is going. You can't see this on the radio, but yeah, I'm putting my hand up in the air. Like
if we had a little kazoo, it'd be like.
But Winter's Bone was the launch, right? Yeah, but it was a league above.
Martha Marcy.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, from a performance point of view, I would hold them both together. I think that like the Winter's Bone, the film was stronger, but Elizabeth Olsen just announced herself in that film. It was just a staggering performance, and I think she's really good in this. And
she's fantastic.
And I think
she's always good, but I don't think the roles that she gets are, yeah, like when you
she's
look
not
at
when, getting X-Men.
Well, no, but she's not getting
roles, is she?
No, but I mean, Martha Marcy was a tough role and not a nice one, I guess. But it was kind of, I don't know, that Winter's Bone is such a stronger character-driven film, I reckon. Mm-hmm. Like the character's very strong.
Fair enough, too. I throw this out there just because I think that. You know, again, free idea, Hollywood. If you can't afford Jennifer Lawrence anymore, you've got Elizabeth Olsen.
Yeah, but so don't put them trapped in
this
film. Kind
of. And I also hope she doesn't just get trapped in these types of titles that she does get that.
Yeah, well, I'd like her to do a Silver Linings Playbook where she gets a decent sized audience and people can really see what she can do because I think she's fantastic.
And I think when I watched it, Elizabeth Olsen didn't remind me of her sister as much, which is good because they're not
at all.
Not the greatest. But she reminded me of Maggie Gyllenhaal. And if Elizabeth Olsen can keep up kind of those sort of titles, I think we were going to see some fantastic, fantastic work out of her.
So Alison Janney's in it as well, and she's fantastic. So really the weak link from a performance point of view is Radner himself, I think, who I felt was a little bit... he wasn't as dimensional as everybody around him.
I haven't seen him play a character other than this character yet. This is basically his character in How I Met Your Mother. I haven't seen his first film, but from watching the trailer, I get the sense it's very, very similar. Right.
Okay, so do we have two words for liberal arts? Now, this is, Si, you might be able to help us out in terms of how wide this is getting a release. Are people going to be able to find this relatively easily? Yes. It seemed to get moved around the schedule a wee bit, didn't it?
Yeah, but you'll find it no problem. There's plenty of places that will be playing it.
And it's opening this week.
Yeah, opens on Thursday. And I think this is a really good antidote, actually, to either the really sort of tough, rugged sort of art house or a foreign language film or the kids movies, family movies like Oz. You know, if you want something that's got a bit of intelligence, that's well played,
a bit more for the grown-ups.
Yeah, a little bit more for the grown-ups.
And
definitely.
It's a really easy watch.
I don't agree with all of its conclusions, though. I just feel there was a wee bit of a cop-out. Like, it asked a few questions and then went, oh, it's a bit hard, we'll run away. But, you know, that's, you know, but it was... you know, I've seen a lot worse.
But maybe we'll see some more. This is his second film, so maybe we'll see some more development.
Yes, exactly. Mm. I think that a name to watch, definitely. Names to watch all over the place. And just in case, the one piece of advice I'd like to give everybody is that if you see Richard Jenkins' name on a poster or in a cast list, then take your chances, because you'll pretty much get your money's worth with him alone. He really is fantastic. So liberal arts, two words, Kayleen.
My two words are soft sophomore.
Nice. Mine are school days. So that is our show for this week. Just the three films. We're in a little bit of a lull, aren't we, in terms of films being released after that mad rush at the beginning of February, late January. So next week on the show, we have a guest reviewer who will be joining us from Auckland, Doug Dillerman. He will join us to talk about the film societies, because those programs are now underway in Auckland and Wellington. So we'll be talking to Doug about that. He is going to see Crispin Glover on Tuesday night, so we'll get a first-hand report about that, and also he'll be helping us review The Red House. So that's our show for next week. And how are people likely to get in touch with us?
You can find us in many places on the interwebs, on Twitter.
We pretty much own it, don't we?
Yeah, basically. You can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle at CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd as Cinematica, and on our website at www.cinematica.co.nz. And a small side note, speaking of Wellington Film Society, congrats to Rebecca McMillan for becoming the new Veep. The Wellington Film Society.
Yep, just yet another commitment to the health of movie going in Wellington. So thanks very much for her for putting her name forward for that. This show is a Guns of Steel production. He said, trying to find the right paragraph. Where am I? The theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. We're leaving you with some more music. This is from Liberal Arts. It's Me and the Mountain. Is the name of the song by Team Me. You notice I don't know who any of these people are. This is how old I am. I need iTunes to explain to me what the difference is between the name of the song and the name of the band. Team Me from their self-titled EP, Me. The song is Me in the Mountain. Until next week, that's all from me.
And me. Good night.
And me. Not the me's.
Me.
They are, things are bad enough as they are, and I'll laugh.